Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, licensed marriage family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all these skills to address the subjects that we all struggle with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist.
Good afternoon, and thank you for tuning in on this Tuesday at 2. It's a beautiful day outside, and a lot of things are going on in the world, and we have chosen a topic this week that is timely but also a little challenging. So I appreciate you tuning in and spending the next hour with us as we do approach a topic that it does impact all of us in certain ways. Maybe it's easy to discount the topic as being something that only affects students, but I actually believe that this is something we all need to talk about, and we need to talk about often because it is those things that we don't talk about that cause us the most trouble. So this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and we get together every Tuesday at 2 to talk about those things going on in our lives, and you can be part of the conversation through our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, on our website, thereluctanttherapist.com. You can always send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com, and you can listen to podcasts of previous shows at kcbx.org under the News and Talk tab. We have all of our shows up from the last couple years. And we also encourage you later in the hour to be a part of the conversation by calling in, and we'll open up the phone lines to your thoughts, concerns, and comments, because that's what makes this more interesting, is the fact that we all come to life from different perspectives. We all come to life from different orientations and different interests, and it's all of those different beliefs and interests and concerns that make up our society and our culture, and it makes us well-rounded. And hearing the different opinions and thoughts and ideas of others makes us better people. So I look forward to hearing your thoughts about the topic later on in the hour. But today, I wonder if I'm a bit of a glutton for punishment because I have just dropped my daughter off at school last week. And bear with me because we're going to be talking about this subject for a while. It's very fresh in my life. And she started her first day of classes today out at Northwestern. And so in line with what came up in the news last week, which was President Obama going ahead and creating a task force to look at sexual assault on college campuses, I thought, well, maybe we need to bring that topic to the show today because it's fresh on my mind. I'm concerned about my daughter's safety being out on her own for the first time in a college campus. And maybe I'm just a little sensitized to this news that everything that has to do with college pops up and feels like it's big and real. But I also think that it's in light of what's happening in the NFL and in the military and on college campuses, this idea of sexual assault or sexual safety, rape, these topics are alive in our culture all the time. And because they are scary topics, we tend to not want to talk about them. We'll have little news flashes. We'll be horrified by footage of a woman being attacked by her fiance. We'll be concerned by news and reports of 1 in 5 women being sexually assaulted on campus. We will be angered by the poor response of the military to sexual assaults on military bases. And yet we don't make the conversation continue on in a way that it impacts us. That it always feels like these stories of sexual assault or rape or harassment are about others. It's the others' story. It's those people. It's football players. It's college students. It's the military. But rarely do we personalize it enough to understand that it's all of our story. Because we all are part of this community. Because we are the parents and the sisters and the brothers and the friends to those others. To people who find themselves in situations that change their life. So I may be a glutton for punishment talking about something that I'm anxious about. But at the same time, I think it would be irresponsible to not have this conversation given all of the information in the news. And I'm fortunate today because I have a guest in the studio who is an expert on this topic. So it doesn't have to fall on me to bring the information. I've brought in Dr. Sean Byrne, professor of psychology at California Polytechnic State University, right up the road here in San Luis Obispo. She is a coworker of mine. She has served as chair of the Department of Psychiatry and Child Development and the Women's – did I say it incorrectly?
Psychology.
All right. Thank you. Department of Psychology and Child Development and the Women's and Gender Studies Department. She worked her way through college and graduated with a bachelor's degree in psychology from Virginia Commonwealth University in 1982 at the age of 20. She received her master's degree in 1984 at the age of 22 and her PhD in 1988 in applied social psychology from Claremont Graduate University. Dr. Byrne has published research articles on a variety of topics and is considered an expert on the psychology of gender and the psychology of sustainability. She is the author of three books, The Social Psychology of Gender, Group Dynamics, Theory and Practice, and Women Across Culture, A Global Perspective. Dr. Byrne specializes in the application of psychology to solve individual, group, and social problems. And through her teaching, research, and consulting, Dr. Byrne is devoted to giving psychology away, that is, teaching people how they can use psychology to address practical problems, which I love because that is actually the whole theory behind this program, is that we should all be talking about those things that sustain our mental health and well-being, that it shouldn't be something you have to pay and go into a secret room to find out about. Mm-hmm. So I appreciate you coming and bringing your wisdom. Also, because Dr. Byrne writes a blog for Psychology Today called Presence of Mind, you also were involved in 2006 in revamping Cal Poly's SAFER program, which addresses sexual assault on campus, and you included intervention, bystander intervention approaches. And your research article on bystander intervention and sexual assault prevention is widely referenced by researchers. So I can't think of anyone better to be here today to talk about sexual assault on college campuses than Dr. Sean Byrne. Welcome.
Well, thank you for having me on the show.
And I'd like to start off for those who maybe haven't been paying attention or up to date with what's going on. There's a few things that kind of inspired this conversation that I wanted to have with you. And the first one, as I mentioned, was this recent White House report that came out talking about the state of rape and sexual assault on campuses. The report was called Rape and Assault, A Renewed Call to Action, which declared that 1 in 5 women have been sexually assaulted on college campuses, but only 12% of student victims actually report. And throughout the country, 22 million women and 1.6 million men, because this is a male and female issue, have been raped in their lifetime. And these victims tend to suffer more in their lifetime for depression, anxiety, substance abuse issues as a result of these rapes. So President Obama, out of concern of having 2 daughters of his own, he said, and they'll be going off to college, and also his concern for what's going on in this country, has created a task force to protect students from sexual assault. The White House report declared that no one in America is more at risk of being raped or assaulted than college women, because they said in part because of the alcohol and substance abuse that happens on campuses that fuels this kind of behavior. So, Dr. Moore, what do you think about that report and this task force?
Well, like you said, about 1 in 5 college women experience sexual assault, and only about 12% of those women report it. A growing networked college anti-rape movement has resulted in a number of these federal actions, including President Obama's concerns about this. Colleges are now, and universities now, being compelled to do a better job of educating and preventing sexual assault and do a better job of supporting victim complainants and also disciplining offenders. So one thing I would say to you as a mom of someone who's just got gone off to college, a daughter who's just gone off to college, is at least things are improving on college campuses as far as education about prevention and risk reduction, and also better opportunities for reporting and disciplining offenders. So a little tiny bit of good news there. I'm not, you know, sure about Northwestern's policies, of course. But right now what we have is Title IX being used. Title IX is a federal civil rights legislation, basically, that prohibits sex-based discrimination in education. And historically in the U.S., this has largely been used to get greater gender parity in funding for sports for girls. Mm-hmm. But recently it's being used by the federal government to get schools to combat sexual violence. And the idea is that the greater threat of sexual violence to women students interferes with the quality of education. And so now, as a result of this sort of re-imaging or this new use of Title IX, schools are required to take action to address sex discrimination, sexual harassment, and sexual violence. They have to have established procedures for handling complaints, and they have to post these on the school's website.
But this doesn't seem to be a new thing, because in your bio, in 2006, you were part of revamping the SAFER program at Cal Poly.
Well, so I'm not going to lie to you. That was a fight.
Okay.
And so this along with another important piece of legislation, the Campus Save Act, which went into effect this March 2014, without those, schools in general were hesitant to provide many resources and to acknowledge the problem of sexual assault on their campuses because it made them look bad. And that was a problem at Cal Poly, too. That, you know, like we had, for a time, there was sort of like this renegade action of red handprints on campus. These
Remember
were
that?
Sort of stenciled red handprints in places on campus where sexual assaults had occurred. And, you know, those, when parents were visiting campus with their prospective students, this was kind of an issue. You know, so, you know, administrations all over the country were somewhat motivated to sweep this problem under the rug. So and then so there so in 2000 so that actually was a little bit difficult at Cal Poly for me to work with interested others to revamp that program. The program at that time still had a very old-fashioned approach. And, you know, curiously enough, so what I'm an applied social psychologist, so we use research to guide our intervention. And what was apparent to me was that a bystander education approach was one of the best approaches out there. And that's because on a college campus, the majority of sexual assaults occur in a party mm-hmm. or date type of situation. And many times bystanders are present in the pre-assault phase. So if we and it turns out, too, that most sexual assault perpetrators, it's about 9%. There's this 9% of men that are sort of serial perpetrators.
Mm-hmm. I read that.
Yeah,
statistic.
Interesting. So, again, the bystander intervention approach is men are not the enemy. Majority of men would never sexual assault. But men, you know, and women, you know, can learn to recognize the red flags of sexual assault risk and then intervene to protect other people.
And to overcome that fear of not looking cool, right?
Yeah,
I mean, I think that's one of the things
that's
a problem is that college students are very concerned about fitting in with their peers. And so they don't want to be the one who calls someone else out. Or I think that's a struggle
yes.
also.
Yeah. And the, what I did in my research was applied the classic Latneian Darley bystander intervention model, which many people have heard of the Catherine Genovese incident and so on. So it was.
I don't know if everyone.
This was that incident in 1968 where the restaurant manager Catherine Genovese is coming home from work and is raped and killed. It apparently there were 38 people who heard some aspect of the attack, and no one calls the police until she's already been murdered. And so then there's this big outcry, you know, what the hell is wrong with people? You know, do they not care? And Latney and Darley suggesting that the decision to intervene in when you're a bystander who witnesses something that's potentially requires your intervention, that decision to intervene is actually really complex. You have to first notice the situation. Then you have to interpret as one where intervention's needed. Then you have to take responsibility for the intervention. Then you have to know what to do to intervene. And then lastly, what you just mentioned, the final step is not having what is called audience inhibition. And what that means is that if there's social norms in the situation such that you're afraid to speak up or do anything because social norms count against it. So, for example, among college students, there's this norm called cock blocking, that you don't cock block. And so, you know, what I found in my research, for example, is some students misinterpreted that as meaning that
stay out of it.
Right, stay yes. out of it. And then the diffusion of responsibility issue is huge, too, because what I found in my research is students often assume that the host of the party is responsible. Mm-hmm. The potential perpetrator's friends are responsible for preventing him from crossing the sexual consent line. The intoxicated person's friends are responsible for keeping her from being exploited by a sexual assault predator. But like you said, it's all of our responsibility, really.
And it does. And it goes back to the idea that we always feel when it's something scary like sexual assault that it happens to others, and that you can be in the presence of this happening and it's hard for you to comprehend that something this horrible is really happening in front of you, that we tend to first want to diminish it or deny that we're seeing an assault.
You know what's funny, though, is people are actually, because of something called optimistic bias, it's actually more effective in sexual assault prevention to focus on the fact that this can happen to other people that you care about, because people, women included, you know, tend to minimize the possibility that bad things can happen to them. You know, people have a belief in a just world where bad things only happen to bad people. And, you know, which also leads to victim blaming when sexual assault does occur.
If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, joined in the studio today by my guest, Dr. Sean Byrne, a PhD professor of psychology at Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo. And we're addressing the topic of sexual assault on college campuses, and maybe not just limited to college campuses, but to sexual assault in general. But we're focusing on college campuses because of the recent task force that was created by President Obama to address the lack of real solid programs on college campuses to address this huge, the word has been thrown out there that it's an epidemic on college campuses, 1 in 12. And this is an issue, I think, that affects all of us, parents, students, but also grandparents, friends, neighbors. What's going on our college campus, I think, has more to do with what we're not teaching our students before we send them off to college than almost what's happening on college. And I want to see what your take of this is, Dr. Byrne. And if you'd like to be part of the conversation, you can call us at 805-781-3875. How does this impact you? What do you think about the issue of sexual assault on college campuses? Is it the responsibility of the universities to step in and take care of this issue? Or is it a criminal justice issue? And do we need to do better work training our police officers in dealing with these criminal cases? There's a lot in the news, a lot going on with it. And we invite your calls, 805-781-3875. So this is just a thought I have about the preparation for our students going off to college, because as a mom, just sending my daughter off, I was very concerned about making sure she had a lot of tools to address adult situations when she left. And I think one of the things that concerns me is that I feel like we're a bit provincial in our sex education in our schools. We have incredible mixed messages that go out in our culture, where you'll have Victoria's Secret, you know, out there on the street with all their women dress very provocatively. We have, you know, very limited standards on television of what we see. The whole dress of, you know, the way that we portray women in the media. I think that we, you know, make sex very much this salacious experience, and we do very little to teach our children about the emotional part of sexuality, or the connection of sexuality, or the, you know, the health of sexuality. And so there's a bit of me that feels like we are missing the boat before the kids go to college. They're going to college and feeling these mixed feelings of drive and desire because they're sexual beings, but not quite sure what to do with it. And so they have to numb themselves in some way and kind of get, you know, go through the process. My guess is that's a part of it. And then the other piece is our lack of drug and alcohol education.
Well, I would caution you to be careful because, like I was saying before, the research seems to indicate that the majority of these sexual assaults are perpetrated by serial sexual assault perpetrators. So you've got this 9% of people who are opportunistic predators. They take advantage of people's intoxication, for example, and do things like engage in drug-facilitated sexual assault. So again, the majority of men, we do have these, like you said, a culture that heavily sexually objectifies women, but the majority of men, we raise good men. We raise them to be respectful in regards to sexual boundaries. The majority of men don't want to violate someone's consent. They would prefer to have sex with someone who wants to have sex with them. So these things that you talk about, that you just spoke of, while important for many reasons, I don't think are the crux of the problem.
Well, and I agree, and I am glad you brought it up, because I think there is the sexual assault issue, and we do keep talking about this idea of serial predators on campus, and that one of the things that the research, I think from 2002, a Dr. Lisick did, mm-hmm. that was kind of spawned this
right.
information that in his research, he found that 6% of the men were causing or were the serial rapists, that of the 2,000 men that he interviewed, 120 of them admitted to raping or assaulting women, and they were responsible for an average of 6 assaults apiece, 439 of them, just of this. So I do want to make sure that we state that.
The other thing to remember too, there are multiple masculinity cultures. Mm-hmm. And there are some masculinity cultures in which it is part of the culture to be misogynist, you know, to see women only in sexual objectified terms. And, you know, some male groups, you know, having norms that condone drugging women, taking advantage of them.
But that is
sexually again, and that is really, really important. And that's too why the bystander intervention approach is so important, and also why men should see. Unfortunately, right now we have a situation too where this increased focus on sexual assault on college campuses is creating a bit of a backlash, where men are feeling victimized, like they are all being treated as sexual assault predators, offenders, and that's, you know, modern sexual assault prevention efforts look at men as allies. You know, these mm-hmm. sexual assault predators give men a bad name. They dishonor men, and so instead of men feeling defensive about this increased focus, they should be helping it turns out men are very good at identifying other men who are at risk for crossing the sexual consent line. And we need to support – men need to support, and men need to develop norms in their cultures that support calling those men out and checking them.
And that was part of the report from the White House, that engaging men in the process of reducing or preventing sexual assault was key. And this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. The number to be part of our conversation with Dr. Byrne is 805-781-3875. Giselle, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. Hello to from a Pitzer graduate to a Claremont University graduate,
hello.
First off. I have so much that I want to say, and I want to thank you for having this talk, because I feel in this county, on college campuses, regardless of the fact that we now have a lot of laws to protect against discrimination based on gender, and we have, at least in theory, very clearly cut procedures by which somebody being sexually assaulted on campus would complain, there is not just a reluctance on the part of the people within the administration or within the college campus that are charged with investigating and following those procedures and getting back in writing to the complainant exactly what steps they took. There's an active obstruction to completing those procedures, and I've found that personally. And when you talk about why men do what they do, whether you think it's a small percentage or a large percentage, I think that percentage changes depending on whether you look at the various ways in which sexual assault can occur. the constants are the desire to gain power. And you'll have a larger percentage of men that do feel like they're losing power, and they're less likely to be sympathetic, you know, when asked to weigh in on an incident that occurred, even whether it's subconscious or consciously hidden.
Well, thank you, Giselle. What do you think, Dr. Byrne, about this issue? Because I think that was my concern before we started the conversation today, was there's the research about sexual assault and the small amount of men who are perpetrating this, but there is still that large percentage of sexual harassment, or, you know, two dumb young college students who drink too much and fumble around in bed, and the next day everyone feels embarrassed. There's a difference between that, and then what Giselle, I think, is talking about is kind of our overall cultural feeling about power and sexuality.
Well, we're in transition, and that's why I'm very excited that we've got Title IX starting to be enforced in regards to sex discrimination. We the Campus Save Act, that program too, recent passage of the law here in California that clearly defines or somewhat clearly defines consent in a different way than it's been defined before. But I agree that historically, and even in recent history, we've had a lot of problems, you know, in regards to pursuing these complaints and victim complainants not being protected from these new in particular, Title IX, you know, things are, but we're still in process.
Well, and I think one of the things that helps is that women or victims are coming together as a group, like what you're talking about, the Title IX lawsuit, I think, is a group of 23 women from Barnard and Columbia University who came together and are suing their administrations for not taking proper action. And I think in groups, we feel mightier. And this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Lucien, thanks for waiting. You're on the air.
Yes. Thank you for answering my call. I'd like to comment on two things. First of all, America still has yet to establish what is healthy sexuality and what are healthy and safe boundaries. And there's not enough education starting right when our kids are children and going to school, into high school, into college. There's not enough education out there to really make sure that growing up people understand what healthy boundaries entail.
I agree. That is a concern.
And the other thing I wanted to say was I went to a movie at the Bay Theater, and I'm not putting down the Bay Theater, but there's a movie there called Walk to the Tombstones. And I walked out of it because in the movie they depicted these sexual sadists who were very sadistic, and then they would just murder their victims. They would grab them and put them in a van, and then they kind of had all this implied torture, sexual torture, and then death.
So it sounds like, Lucien, that this feels for you like this message of no sexual boundaries, or maybe too much freedom of sexuality, is sending a wrong message. But I think, and I don't know if Dr. Byrne will concur, is that I don't think the research supports that, you know, seeing a violent film or being in a violent sport like football creates sexual perpetrators.
Well, like everything with human behavior, is complex, you know, and you need a situation by person perspective. And what I mean by that is, for some people, viewing violent media can fuel violent desires and so forth. But, you know, clearly most of the people who see such media don't go out and rape or don't go out and sexually assault. But at the same time, it's one of many confusing messages out there for them. I mean, you're, Lucien, certainly right about, you know, one thing we need to do as we're raising our children is educating them about sex and sexuality is emphasizing what consent actually means.
And he did also brought up the idea of healthy sexual relationships, which was a bit of what I talked about earlier, that I'm concerned that we're a little too provincial in our sex education, that we, you know, don't want to talk about sexuality with our children because we're afraid then they'll go out and do it.
Yeah.
So they're learning this information from the media and television shows.
And unfortunately from internet pornography.
And exactly. And what concerns me is in 2014, we should know better because we were this provincial in 1950 and we should have advanced our ability to talk about it. And this is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, joined in the studio today by my guest, Dr. Sean Byrne, professor at Cal Poly University. And you are invited to be part of the conversation. We're talking about sexual assault on college campuses and how do we address this epidemic on college campuses? How do we help college campuses take steps to be more proactive, be more able or willing to address the problem? What are your thoughts on this? Questions or concerns? 805-781-3875. We'll be back to talk to Margie and Ruth.
The KCBX Fall Pledge Drive goes to the airways in October, but if you make an early gift by midnight on September 29th, your name will be automatically entered in a sweepstakes drawing for an iPad Apple Air, Apple's newest, lightest, and most advanced tablet. Send in your renewal form, pledge online at kcbx.org, or call us at 549-8855. Thanks for doing your part to keep KCBX Central Coast Public Radio on the air.
Today we're talking about sexual assault on college campuses in lieu of the new task force that President Obama has formed to address this issue after the White House report was released, this week, talking about that in no other area of America are women more at risk for being raped or assaulted than on our college campuses. And for all of the parents who have dropped their children off at college this year or already have had children in the college system, and we know that this is a real and very scary situation or topic to talk about. And I wanted to say that, you know, from the report and from the task force, they came up with three things that they wanted to focus on to address the high rate of rapes on campus. And one of the first things that the report said that they believe from the report, and Dr. Brown, I'll let you comment on this, was that most of these rapes and assaults were fueled by drinking and drug abuse that can incapacitate the victims, that this was played a huge role in these women being targeted by predators, that the, one of the interviews that I read, an interview of a predator, someone who had been a serial rapist on a college campus, he talked about how he would seek out a freshman when she first came into a party and kind of offer her a drink and kind of work her through this process.
It's like a grooming.
Yeah, a very grooming experience. And so, you know, this idea of sending our young women to college campuses without the, you know, knowledge or the ability to spot these predators or to not be a victim is important. The report talked about needing, they want, President Obama said you have 90 days, college campuses, to give us recommendations on how you're going to prevent and respond to sexual assault. Colleges need to increase public awareness of each school's track record, which you mentioned earlier the schools were really hesitant to do because they don't want their schools to look...
Get that bad press.
That bad press. Yes. But the administration is saying you need to own it, what's going on your campus. And the third piece was to enhance coordination among federal agencies to hold schools accountable if they don't combat sexual assault. And you said you're feeling a bit hopeful that this...
Well, for one, these federal acts force colleges to do something about it. They can no longer get away with pretending it's not a problem on their campus. They have to have risk reduction programs. They have to have clear reporting guidelines on their websites. They have to have bystander education now and risk reduction information. I mean, that's huge. Many colleges and universities didn't offer that, or it was somewhat half-assed. I mean, it's only within I think the last 3 years that Cal Poly has had a full-time person assigned to sexual assault prevention and education. and risk reduction and support for survivors. And we had to fight for that. They didn't want to allocate those monies. These types of legislation, they are forcing the hand of the universities, and we ought to see some improvements.
Which would be really hopeful. Also, not just for the universities, but as we know, the behaviors on universities tend to trickle down into the greater culture. And so that awareness about sexual assault and rape hopefully will also trickle down into other areas. Ruth, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind today?
I was kind of processing this idea that 1 in 12 college women are going to be sexually assaulted. And then I was also processing the information about being by and large at the hands of a repeat offender. Mm-hmm. And so this is suggesting that college campuses have a whole lot of repeat offenders that are on site in a target-rich environment. And so I'm wondering, what is the suggestion here? You know, if we have young vulnerable women, is there also some attraction for these repeat offenders to immerse themselves in this target-rich environment? But it just sounds to me that it's not something you would expect, that a college campus would have so many repeat offenders in such a condensed population.
Thank you. Dr. Byrne, what do you think?
Well, I don't know whether the proportion of or percentage of serial perpetrators on the college campus is actually any greater. But like you said, they have sort of a captive population, and alcohol is definitely available, more available as a tool for sexual assault given the partying. I'm not sure how to make you feel better. It doesn't, other than through our sexual assault prevention efforts, we are reaching out to fraternities, to athletic teams, et cetera, trying to promote bystander intervention and for these different masculinity cultures, for them to explicitly develop norms that don't protect these serial perpetrators, because that, of course, has been a problem, too. Like in our fraternities, they'll close ranks around a member in order to protect the image of the fraternity. We are definitely working on it.
Anything else, Ruth?
It would just seem to me that if we're assuming that college students are of the more educated background and also of the more educated future, that maybe the type of education needs to be addressed, because this is someone who's choosing to pursue a higher level of education, and yet these are also the people who are perpetrators. And so that to me is sort of the conflict, that we would assume that they do have a higher level of common sense and life skill and problem solving in order to achieve entrance into a university, and yet they seem to be more pervasive.
Well, and I don't think statistically they're more pervasive than in the greater population.
I don't think so.
I think one of the concerns
that we have evidence of that anyway.
But I think your concern, Ruth, is that, you know, we have higher standards if we are sending young people to a college campus, that they should know better. But I don't know if it's just a matter of choice with the perpetrators of sexual assault, that it's that they're, you know, going to college knowing that they're perpetrators. Because I think also, and Dr. Byrne, you can correct me if I'm wrong, that when reading the research that Dr. Lissick did, that the interviews he did of these young men who were serial perpetrators, they didn't identify themselves as doing anything other than what was normal or okay or social norm on their college campuses.
Well, if you and it could be interesting to get a licensed clinical social worker or licensed psychologist who's worked with the sexually violent predators that were once housed at Atascadero State Hospital. They've all been transferred to Kalinga, but most of the experts who work with these serial perpetrators will tell you that a lot of them have psychopathic tendencies, et cetera. So, people with psychopathic tendencies can be found through all walks of life, and chances are those people use that intelligence to continue perpetrating, to some extent, forms of sexual violence when they go out there and have their power as educated people with degrees from, you know, prestigious universities, unfortunately. So,
Ruth, thank you so much for calling in. And this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. If you'd like to join this conversation today, our number is 805-781-3875. I'm here in the studio with Dr. Sean Byrne, and we're talking about the squirmy topic of sexual assault. And it's something that needs to be addressed, even though it makes us all uncomfortable, because this idea of sending our children off to college campuses and whether or not they're safe and what's going on, we really need to talk about it, because that's when we start to make change. Margie, thanks for waiting. You're on the air. What's on your mind?
Hi. First of all, my name is Margie Englund. My husband...
Hi, Margie.
Hi. Worked with Dr. Byrne. In listening, I have two thoughts. Okay. One is that I raised three daughters and helped raise three granddaughters. And there was a lot of role-playing and kind of model mugging sort of stuff that went on in our family. You know, if this happens and if this begins to happen, if you feel funny, do this, be aggressive. We tend to be very assertive women, all of us. And so training your young woman, your girl, your five-year-old, to take good care of her own body and giving her the tools to do that, I think brings it down to a very personal family level, parenting level.
Well, risk reduction is really important, but we have to be careful, too, in doing our risk reduction, not to suggest that the blame lies on the person who's sexually assaulted because he or she didn't take enough risks. So that's been kind of a tricky area for sexual assault prevention.
And my next comment is tricky and provocative, but I want to know what your take on this is. As the new students come into Cal Poly and my being in town in San Luis Obispo, and the other night in a particular restaurant, seven young girls. They were obviously freshmen. They came in to get an order. There were, I think of the seven, five of them whose shorts, jean shorts, cutoffs, were so short that their butt cheeks were hanging out. And when they sat down, you could tell that they didn't have any underwear on. My gut-level reaction, and I admit it is gut-level, visceral reaction, was, my God. You know, it's like, okay, excuse me for saying this, but it's like, here it is. Come and get it.
Well, and I think Margie brings up a question or a comment that makes the subject squirmy, Dr. Byrne, because we don't want to victimize the victims. We don't want to shame the victims. But I think for a lot of people in their heads, they're thinking, do young women need to be safer in this? And I think what we need to separate out is we're talking, on one hand, sexual assault by repeat offenders on campus, what we would consider sexual predators. And then on the other hand, there might be another conversation about just the sexuality on campus and, you know, young college students acting in a way that they find themselves fumbling around at night in the dark and maybe having sex with someone that they would regret in the morning. But that is a different topic in ways of this sexual assault by predators who are preying on
exactly
women.
And it's also important to realize that victims of sexual assault aren't necessarily young and attractive, and one should be able to wear whatever one wants to wear without being blamed. Should one be sexually assaulted? Now, in the mind of misogynist serial sexual assault perpetrator who feels entitled to women's bodies and feels entitled to taking them and has such issues with women that they want to exercise power over them, they will use anything as an excuse, too. They would use such shorts as a possible justification that she was asking for it. But again, you know, teaching our men what consent means. I mean, obviously, that's not a young woman doesn't dress like that thinking, this is I'm asking to be sexually assaulted. She's not. She may want to be perceived as sexually attractive. She may want men to be possibly interested in her as a sexual partner. But that is the big difference between that and wearing something. No woman puts on her party dress saying, this dress is the one I want to wear, so I'll get sexually assaulted.
But I do think, and again, it's that fine line between definitions of what's happening. We might be talking about a matter of taste. You know, we might be looking at these young women saying, really? That's not very tasteful from a different perspective. But as you said, Dr. Burnett, we run this risk of not addressing the assault aspect of it if we talk about the taste aspect. We probably don't want our daughters out there flaunting what they have just from a taste level. But at the same time, we don't want our young women to feel like if they are assaulted that they on some way level asked for it, because that's why we only have 12%
exactly.
of our victims reporting, because there is that feeling in our culture that if a young woman gets attacked, she is in some way responsible.
And there's a lack of empathy, too. So,
absolutely.
For survivors, which, like you said, affects reporting, but it also affects recovery from sexual assault. Now, what we're trying to do, you know, in the sexual assault prevention programming is be clear about what means consent, and wearing short shorts with your bag end hanging out is not consent,
right?
You know,
and I do think that that's what makes the conversation tricky, because of the tendency we have to want to find blame outside of the fact that it is an assault. Because if we can, as a population, say, well, she was asking for it, or she was in the wrong place, or she was drunk, then somehow it becomes the other's problem again and not our problem as a culture in addressing it. And Margie, I appreciate you taking the time to call. If you're just tuning in, this is a conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can learn more about the program on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. You can write your comments there if you're not comfortable calling in, or you can send me an email to Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Find out more at thereluctanttherapist.com, our website. And if you'd like to podcast this show, if you missed any of it, it will be available at kcbx.org right after the show ends. And Rick, I appreciate you waiting. What's on your mind today?
I think we need to look at the whole picture of violence, not just simply sexual, but the fact that violence has become glorified in our society. And it's weird if you're a guy and violence is condoned. If you actually go down that path, you feel like you have a right to inflict violence. And I think that's a mistake to begin with. I think there's a real deep-seated problem in our society now where violence is justified. And again, you know, I don't think every guy is liable to do that by any means. But people who, for whatever reason, have gone down that path and think they have a right to commit violence, I think it leads into that kind of behavior.
So what do we do, Rick? How do we address that?
I think we have to focus on peaceful solutions to problems. I think one of the biggest problems in the world today is the idea that might makes right, mm-hmm. and whoever's got the biggest bombs and stuff is on top of the heap. I think it's an entirely mistaken concept. I think we have to focus on love, acceptance, understanding, and communication.
So a little bit I hear in your voice is the idea of entitlement, the, you know, might makes right, that we might have a culture that feels like if we are alive, we get to take what we want. And maybe that needs to be addressed. And also, the thing about violence I find interesting, Dr. Byrne, because I was in researching for the show, I was looking at what's going on in the NFL also. And there was a story that came out that was talking about this idea that, well, the NFL is such a violent sport that you shouldn't be surprised that there's more sexual assault or, you know, sexual misbehavior in the NFL because these players are trained to be violent. And yet they'd done a study looking at violent occupations where you would expect higher rates of sexual assault or domestic violence. And they actually found in studying the military and also in the NFL that they didn't have higher rates of sexual assault or domestic violence, that much higher than the general population.
Well, the military, actually, you know, you had said that college women are at greatest risk. Women, yes, in the military at a much higher risk, three times the risk of the average woman. And Native American women, too, are at a much higher risk. Yeah.
So that's a conflicting report then to the research that I read about this idea that, you know, in the general population, the rate of domestic violence and sexual assault was not that much higher than what went on in these seemingly violent places.
Well, I think Rick is onto one thing, and okay, and that is, again, back to this idea of masculinity cultures. You know, we in some ways we have. And in particular, in regards to particular men's cultures, promoted the there are norms that support men using their physical strength to solve their problems. You know, so that certainly is true. And what there are a lot of people out there, including psychologists in the men's movement division. I think it's 52 of the American Psychological Association, the Psychology of Men and Masculinity. And also men's activists across the country working to redefine masculinity in ways that don't involve resolving conflicts through strength or don't require dominating women. So, but the NFL, let's face it, you know, the culture there has been a very a masculinity culture that has, to some extent, allowed violence in personal front. Sort of an exporting of those aggressive norms within the sport into their personal lives. And then the NFL has protected them.
Right, you know, which is what we get into the college campuses, protecting their reputation.
Right.
What else, Rick?
Well, I think as a male, having been in the military, for example, I found that the people in the military were far more violent than people in society as a whole, mm-hmm, when I was in. And also I played football in high school, and there was a lot more violence there. It's an attitude of being able to use your personal power against someone, mm-hmm, as opposed to using it for people as a whole. So I think that, you know, glorifying conflict is a serious mistake. You know, it's like if you glorify love and peace, then people tend to gravitate in that direction. I think that's why we had that huge movement in the 60s. And then the reaction to it from the establishment in the 1980s was, you know, well, war is good under these conditions. And they had to demonize, you know, Russia and create this huge Cold War. And then all these other wars started sprouting up. There are people who enjoy violence. And I don't think...
Well, I'm sorry, Rick. I agree, and I don't want to go too far down the other path of the global issue of violence, although I do think it is important to the topic of men and masculinity and sexual assault. But I do think that we need to go back to that conversation another time. Rick, and I hope you'll call in. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett with Dr. Sean Byrne as my guest today, and we're talking about the recent report by the White House about sexual assault on college campuses and this mandate by President Obama that college campuses actually do something about it, that we don't just have policies or programs on campus, which Cal Poly proudly has had for many years, but having the program now is not enough, that we are now mandating that colleges do something about it, that come up with a way to actually prevent and respond to sexual assault, to increase public awareness about each school's track record of sexual assault on campus, and to enhance coordination among federal agencies to hold schools accountable if they don't comply. And this is new language in addressing this issue, and I think maybe it's new language that that goes in hand with women feeling more empowered to speak out about their experiences on college campuses and not wanting to be victimized or, you know, to carry that shame. And there was the young woman from Columbia University, Emma Sokolowitz, who is doing sort of a performance art piece of dragging her mattress, her dorm mattress, behind her everywhere she goes this year on campus, or until her alleged assailant is thrown out of the school. And she has joined with 23 other young women from Barnard and Columbia University in suing the administration to take action and to remove predators from college campuses, to treat them like the sexual offenders that they are, the sexual perpetrators that they are. And the language also, the way that we are addressing sexual assault in the 90s, you know, there was the big movement of Take Back the Night, mm-hmm. and that women were and men were marching together so that women could feel safe at night. But in 2014, the new campaign that's been kicked out by college women is called Kick the Bastards Out. Mm. So no longer are women wanting to stand by and feel victimized, but we want to take back our college campuses. And thank you, Rick, for taking the time to call, because I think it's important, again, that we talk about this issue that is on a spectrum of many issues. And one end, we have the sexual assault with predators. And the other end of the spectrum, we also have the issue of sending our young students onto college campuses who might not have the sex education or the understanding of how to, you know, be with alcohol and the sexuality and consent that's on a different level.
Yeah, and I want to say a couple of things, as we're almost out of time. Mm-hmm. I know some people with college-age sons might be worried. They hear, you know, that it's becoming easier for people to file complaints. There's more talk about consult. The new California law defines consent as the presence of a clear yes rather than the absence of a no. A lack of protest or resistance or silence doesn't mean consent. If she didn't say yes, consent hasn't been granted, you know.
And if she's passed out in the midst of
or intoxicated, exactly. And so that's, I think that's it scares some men. There's been a bit of a backlash against this new movement to draw greater attention to the problem of sexual assault on campuses. But I'd want to remind people that according to the FBI, only 8% of rape reports are unfounded. So if someone says they have been raped, it's best to believe them, provide them with support, understand that responses to sexual assault are quite varied, and to encourage them to seek help through local or national resources. So RAINN, RAINN, is a national organization, and they will, from anywhere in the United States, you can call them toll-free, and they will refer you to local resources. They also provide counseling via computer or via the phone. So help is out there. But we do need to support and believe people when they say they've been sexually assaulted. And the odds are that your son will not be falsely accused of sexual assault, especially if he understands what consent means. I know some people, they'll say, you know, she was drunk, so she couldn't provide consent, but he was drunk, so he couldn't understand consent. Shouldn't he get a bit of a pass? You don't get a pass when you drunk drive, you know.
That's right.
And back to bystander intervention, you know, we're really asking college students, too, to be aware of what situations are high in sexual assault risk, and that includes situations involving drug and alcohol, partying situations, high at risk. Remember, too, most of these rapes are not stranger rapes. 80 to 90% of the time, the victim knows her, knows the perpetrator. We need to party in packs and keep an eye on each other. And we have designated drivers. You know, we need to add that to his or her responsibilities, that he or she also learns about a situation's high in sexual assault risk and intervenes.
Don't be afraid to be embarrassed. Yes. Speak out. Better to be embarrassed
than to have someone's life be ruined.
Absolutely. Thank you, Dr. Sean Byrne, for being my guest today. This has been A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. If you missed any of the show, you can listen to the entire podcast immediately following at kcbx.org. You can contact me at elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com and our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist. As always, I appreciate the opportunity to spend an hour with you each week, and I hope you'll continue supporting and tuning into your public radio station, KCBX.
There you have it.